Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com.
From hanselminutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 506. In this episode, Scott talks with John Henry from CoFound Harlem about today's startup accelerators.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with John Henry. He's the managing director at CoFound Harlem. How are you, sir?
I'm all right, buddy. How about yourself?
I'm very well. Thanks for chatting with me today. Folks can find CoFound Harlem at cofound.co. Very cool URL.
Thank you. Swanky, isn't it?
Nicely done. Nicely done. Now, I hear a lot of words like accelerator, incubator, startup incubator. What you don't like the word incubator?
I wouldn't say I don't like it. I think that actually I have strong opinions about the whole thing. I think that the whole startup space right now is full with kind of with a lot of jargon. And when I was looking to start this project, it was elusive to me what the difference was. And as I looked a little bit deeper, I see that the difference is really minute, and it's kind of up to the founders themselves to determine what it is that they'd like to be called. But I will say that the primary difference is that accelerators are usually a lot more intense and rigorous and tend to be shorter in length and oftentimes invest in the companies, although not necessarily.
So for people who don't know what any of this is, that there's a company out there that accelerates other companies. How exactly does that work? Do you take a piece of them? Or do you give them a place to start out, to stay? How does that process work?
Sure. No, that's a great question. So typically, and I'll speak, I guess, on behalf of CoFound Harlem as opposed to accelerators as a whole. But what we do is we seek promising early stage companies from anywhere and everywhere across the U.S. And we provide them with, initially, it was 50,000 in-kind office space and world-class mentorship. So we were really fortunate early on to have some great mentors from Google and New York Times and MSNBC and what have you. And what made CoFound Harlem really different and what gives us a bit of a social angle is that we took zero equity from these companies. And in exchange, the companies commit to grow in Harlem for a period of 4 years after the initial 9-month program. And so that's how we do it, although we're pivoting into a bit of a different thing, and I can talk about that later. But for the folks out there listening right this minute, there are accelerators that more commonly do something like they give you $50,000 up front. It's a 3-month program, and they might take anywhere from 5 to 7% of equity in exchange for essentially not only the money, but the mentorship and the time that they invest into you. And the idea is that, you know, they kind of churn through all these cohorts and their startups go on and do well. And eventually you might see some upside if you build good enough companies.
You know, there was a show called All American Inventors, kind of like Shark Tank, you know. They're basically the TV version, you know, which isn't the real version of these accelerators. And it seems very, I've always felt that they take such a large amount of your company for such a small, relatively small amount of money. Like if you need money, 50 grand's a lot of money. Make no mistake, 50 grand's a lot of money. But for 5%, for 7% of your company, it sure seems a little bit, I don't know, dangerous. I think it's cool that you're really investing in the community rather than the community first and the company second almost.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I certainly think that accelerators can be a pitfall. In fact, as I've been diving into this space quite a bit, there are really, really few accelerators that do a good job at all. And Y Combinator is certainly kind of the poster child. Mm-hmm. They've just done a phenomenal job over the course of the last 10 years, really setting the bar for what it means to build a successful company. And so if anyone out there is considering beginning a startup and looking into an accelerator, I do think that there are some other solid ones out there, but I certainly, certainly recommend doing your homework. Because like you said, 50,000, when you're first starting out, 50K seems kind of like the end all be all. But in truth, the value of accelerators lies much more in the network that they provide for you and the quality of mentors that they can bring onto the program.
Mm-hmm. Now, forgive me, you said something where you said 50,000 in kind. What does that mean?
So we have a bunch of resources that we offer our startups, mm-hmm. i.e., legal, accounting, etc. And usually these costs can mount up to quite a bit mm-hmm. in the early days. And so what we did was we got really creative with value exchange, mostly because we didn't have the cash to offer our startups. So mm-hmm. we had to offer some other type of value. And it really worked out well because what we ended up landing on was 9 months of free office space as opposed mm-hmm. to the standard 3 that you see.
Right.
And 50K in kind, as I mentioned, and great mentors in the type program.
So that in kind though, mm-hmm. For people who maybe don't have English as their first language, that mm-hmm. means $50,000 in value of services. Is that correct?
Yes, correct. So that looks like potentially $15,000 of legal services, let's say. And, especially when you're incorporating your startup, it can be quite expensive. So mm-hmm. legal or accounting services and software as well. I know we've worked with Microsoft and they offer hosting for our companies and Amazon does as well, et cetera, et cetera.
I see. Mm-hmm. So you could be an accelerator where, hey, I've got this great idea. I pitch you. You write me a big check for 50 grand and I go out and I got to start hunting for tech startup lawyers and social media strategists and I pay them what I think is the right amount of money. But ultimately,
precisely.
You're almost cutting out the middleman where the middleman is a big pile of cash.
Precisely, precisely. And we thought that was certainly very interesting. And although we're just now finishing up our first 9 month cohort next month, which we're very excited about, but taking this kind of this different approach to it has really, really tightened up our business acumen here at the program and gotten us to hone in on the things that matter most because cash can be a distraction. And it's an interesting thing to talk about and to look at in terms of startups raising cash and using that as a metric for success.
Well, I think that they see the cash and they want to buy computers and office space. And
yeah, totally.
If you can remove that and simply make the product,
exactly.
It'll be better for everyone. You've got a list on your website. If you go to cofound.co/accelerate, you've got mm-hmm. a list of mentors. And this, mm-hmm. this is a very diverse group of talent from all over. You got someone from Rap Genius, got someone from NBC, someone from Google. Are these volunteers? Are they, how do you have such a fantastic and kind of illustrious group of people from the city of New York?
Yeah. Yeah. So and thanks for that. I'm sure they'd appreciate hearing that. And, in truth, the way that I got a lot of these people is just, it's so funny. It's just the way that it worked out. Before I became an entrepreneur, I was a doorman and I was doormanning at a building that's just so near and dear to my heart. It's in Williamsburg, Brooklyn on the waterfront there. And it just so happened to be the home of so many great founders. So the founders of Rap Genius live there and the founders of Voxy live there and the guy from Dooney and Burke and really more than a handful of these mentors lived in the building. And I was always super, super earnest and genuine and took pride in my work. I think that's something that came from my parents, having been immigrants. They always taught me, John, whatever you do, do it really well. And so when I was doormanning, I was the best damn doorman you could find. You know, I would learn your name, your kids' names, your pets' names, etc. And so eventually I got my first business opportunity to start my first company. And I went on and I did that, but I stayed in close touch with a lot of these folks. And I think that they couldn't help but to build this emotional connection with, kind of my evolution as an entrepreneur from having run my first startup and now doing this. And so that's really what kind of got the boat rolling. And the rest of them, the cool thing about doing a mission-driven company is that typically, if the mission is compelling enough, you can get people to buy into the vision and be a little bit more forgiving of the fact that there's limited resources to begin with. And so that has been really key for us as well, I believe.
Some people say that it's, you know, that it's the constraint that drives innovation, right? If you simply wrote everyone a check for $1 million, they might not create the same stuff.
Totally. Agreed.
What do the people who are the mentors providing the in-kind value get out of it? Are they volunteers, or are they just, they get the sense that they're building a community?
Yep. It's been a mixture of both. Right this minute, though, as we're looking towards our next cohort and really making our offering a bit more robust, we're looking at a term called entrepreneurs in residence, where essentially we'd be paying a select group of these mentors to be a little bit more involved with the accelerator program and hang around a bit more. But as of late, it's been these mentors are typically there's four per company, four assigned per company, and they allocate a certain amount of time, certainly not anything too crazy, but they allocate time to have office hours with the startups. And so for the companies, it works really well. If, for instance, they're looking to foster a relationship with the New York Times, or if they're a media-based company, as an example, then some of our mentors here make good connections for them. They can just kind of groom their growth as they go along, et cetera. And they get nothing in return, really, other than just the sense of building a community.
So, for example, I could potentially quit my job tomorrow and go and become the CTO at some startup. That could be a job I could have theoretically, or I could become.
Totally.
But I could become like 1/8 of a CTO or 1/4 of a CTO, right? And give a new startup a slice of me and, you know, 8 hours a week, something like that, right?
That's kind of a fresh way to look at it. Yeah.
You like that? Okay. Yeah, you can use that.
I'll give you credit.
Okay, cool. So that makes sense. So then if you look at the list here, you've got people who have expertise in DevOps, and you've got people who have expertise in education and tech startup lawyering and all that kind of stuff.
Totally.
So then as someone who joins a cohort, you get access to those people, and then you are assigned, your four or five, basically your team gets bigger. You know, you go from being a solo co-founder to you'd have like a support network.
Totally. And we don't typically, like solo founders to begin with. But you can certainly see this as a more robust kind of extension of your team.
Well, let's talk about that idea. This, you had a great article in June of this year called 5 Ways to Survive Being a Solo Founder.
Yes.
But you're not a programmer. Is that correct?
Correct.
Because you can't do everything, right? You can't necessarily be the business head and be the tech head. So how do you feel that there always needs to be a tech head and a business head? Like how many different people is like the sweet spot for a startup?
Great question. So that really depends on, there's a couple of key variables here. And I think it's highly dependent on the ambition of the founder and what this company means to you. Right. So I think that lately there's been a lot of pressure, it seems, from the media and what have you, from the tech crunches and the companies raising $15 million and $180 million to go and be this ginormous Uber-like company. And that's certainly a valid aspiration, I think, and something that really excites me as an investor now. But also, let's not, for every one of those types of companies, there's 100,000 perhaps that really just want to have their own companies that generate 200,000, 250,000 that they can make a comfortable living for themselves. And so I think it first starts with kind of that barometer. How big do you want to take this? And if you do happen to fall into the bucket of, okay, I've thought about it and I don't want to just make 200K and make enough for myself and my spouse, I really want a high growth startup. Then it's all about what problem that you're solving. And certainly we hear a lot of talk about the why being more important than the what. And I totally agree with that. But assuming that you've kind of gone through these ranks and you have a strong why and you're totally hell bent on this being high growth, then I think that the sweet spot is anywhere from 2 to 3. Anytime you get into 4+, I think you have, and it's certainly not always the case because one of our portfolio companies is a 4-person team, but you suffer the risk of having too many cooks in the kitchen where it slows down your decision-making process and what have you. And then one person, I just don't think it's enough to tackle the workload of a startup. So anywhere from 2 to 3 is nice. And we like to say a mixture of like a hustler and a hacker, or a hustler, hacker, designer usually makes a really nice mix.
This episode of Hansel Minutes is brought to you by Braintree, code for easy online payments. If you're building a mobile app and you're searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. The Braintree V.0 SDK makes it easy to offer multiple mobile payment types, so you can start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, credit cards, and more, all with a single integration. One small snippet of code and you're set up in less than 10 minutes. If you don't have time, you can give them a call. They'll even handle the integration for you and walk you through it. The SDK supports 7 languages: .NET, Node, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby. Elegant code, clear documentation. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/Hanselman. That's braintreepayments.com/Hanselman. I think that within them, kind of the mythos and the legends of startups, and they are just that, they are myth. There's, you know, there's the Steve Jobs and then the Wozniak, or there's the Bill Gates and the Ballmer. You know, there's the hustler and the hacker. And that does seem to be a good balance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to piggyback off that and just dive into, I wanted to dive into this hustler hacker thing, because I think it's easy to say, but one of the elephants in the room, I believe, is this whole notion of how does a non-technical person deal with a technical person? What's that relationship like? What kind of lapses in communication are there? What are some assumed knowledge coming from both parties? I just would love to dive into that. I know most of the audience listening right now are fairly technical, and perhaps they're kind of curious about the business side of things. Is it necessary? Right. What's more important? Who's more valuable? How do I communicate the product? Who has unrealistic expectations, et cetera? What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think there's this, you know, there's that phrase, wag the dog, right? Is the dog wagging the tail, or is the tail wagging the dog? And sometimes I feel like technical people, and I am definitely at fault in this as well. I've done this in the past. Make the tech because the tech is cool,
right?
And they don't think about fundamentals. They don't think about the business. They don't think about marketing it. I have a little startup that I made with my friend Greg Shackles. We are 2 techies though, and we made a dictation application, so you can dictate into your iPhone, and it automatically the dictation goes into the cloud and then drops into Windows.
Oh, that's pretty neat.
Exactly. That's like, hey, that's cool. But we don't have any business knowledge. We struggled to put the LLC together. We still don't have the lawyer thing worked out.
Right.
Honestly, from a business perspective, we have no business plan. We just made something awesome, and we just thought that it would light the world on fire.
Right.
It really didn't. You know what I mean? It just, like, I still feel like I could wake up tomorrow and maybe the world would have been lit on fire by our thing. But ultimately, that's a great example of, you know, 2 techies making a techie thing, and then now we're disappointed that it didn't change the world.
Right. And one of the things that kind of came to mind as you were speaking is, again, it's so incredibly important for the person, like, self-awareness here is huge. The person, the individual, must determine what it is that they're looking to do. So for a tech person that's just building really nifty products like the arcade that you have behind you and what have you, that's totally fine. Like, there's a time and a place for that. Amen. If that's all you want to do kind of on the side while you work your main gig, then that's fine. However, if you're actively looking to build a business, a startup, then I think that this business acumen becomes important, although I differ from a lot of folks on this. I do think that business people are less and less valuable nowadays. I do think that MBAs, I don't know, they're increasingly less relevant to how business is conducted in now's world. And this is as a business guy, but what's interesting for me in my personal development is my business acumen was not developed through school. I dropped out my first semester. Mm. My business acumen was developed through actually doing it. And I do think that humans learn in a very specific way. You only get good at doing exactly what you want to do. And I'm sure a lot of us have heard this example of, you know, let's say basketball or golf. I can get Tiger Woods to every hour of every day that I'm awake for years just speak to me about putting the golf ball. But until I go out on that green and do it myself, I'm not going to get any better at it. And so with that said, tech folks who are interested in building a product, mm-hmm. if the why you're doing it is there and it's burning inside of you and you can't not do it. You wake up every day and you really strongly believe in this. Sure, this business stuff might not come naturally to you, but it will slowly but surely begin revealing itself to you through relentless perseverance. And while I do think that business folks add some value, I think increasingly less so.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like experience, there needs to be a balance. Like I think if someone gets an MBA, and we're not trying to pick on MBAs, but we'll just use the term MBA to refer to business folks in general.
Perfect.
I think that my wife has an MBA. She knows more about this stuff than I do. But I think that if you expect that you're going to pop out of MBA school, out of business school, ready to like hit the ground and make a business, right. That's not going to happen.
Exactly. You know?
But I think that when I meet people who had an internship, you know, when it became interns and then built a business, you know, as after their MBA, I always like programs that balance the academic and the realistic. Like when I did my software engineering degree, which is not computer science, it's actually software engineering. It was required to get an internship at the end of the program, and your last term before you got your degree had to be an internship at a real company. And sweet. I thought that was very practical. They literally forced you. You could not graduate unless you worked somewhere. And
they should do
that more. Like every college should do that, you know? When people immigrate to the US, and they do like, they want to get an H1, they want to get a work visa.
Totally.
There's this thing called, optional practical training, right? It's basically a year after you graduate from college where you can work in the US to get your, you know, you get your practical training. That's something that immigrants do, but it seems like people that were born here just take a year off, you know. Why isn't there a fifth implied year of undergraduate? You do your school, and then you go out and you work for a year, and we just know that you have to go and work for a year. And you not work for a year to make money, but work for a year to learn.
Right.
It sounds
right.
like you accelerated that. You did your semester, and then you're like, okay, I don't learn effectively like this. I'm going to go out in the world and learn effectively.
Yeah, no, sure. And there's certainly much to be said for that. I'm sure we can have discussion after discussion on this subject. Mm-hmm. I do think education right this minute is ripe for disruption, precisely because it's proving more and more to be less relevant, in my view. I think it's less relevant because startups are increasingly a growing part of our GDP. Mm-hmm. In fact, the internet, I was reading the study, is pretty interesting. The internet accounts for, if it were its own section in the GDP, for 3.4% of GDPs across 12 large developed countries, which I thought was fascinating. And so it's not going away. It's here. And now that we have mobile devices, it's just creating opportunities for previously unthinkable, scalable business models. And so we're just seeing technology applied to so many different fields that otherwise didn't have it. And it's exploding. And I think education and government is just lagging behind. So I do think, to your point, that we need to start seeing some fusion of behind the textbook and application.
Yeah.
And so I'm excited to see what comes of that. I am. It's something that I kind of have on my radar quite a bit.
So let me ask you this, though. On your page, you have education partners, though.
Yes.
You've got the Fordham University.
Great
you've
call.
Got the Design Innovation Center. Are these partners that you've selected because they have a disruptive perspective on education?
Great question. I've never had anyone ask me that. And also a great observation there. I am very passionate about making sure that entrepreneurship is, if not a viable alternative to higher education, should you feel that you don't learn well in university, at least supplementary to your education, if you do indeed think that this path is for you. And so the folks over at Fordham University have a phenomenal data department. In fact, the actual branch, if you will, is called the Center of Digital Transformation. And their students are just dying to get their hands on any real data problems, which I find interesting. The director over there told me, he's like, John, these problems, you know, and their kids are bright, but they're solving theoretical problems. And they're so out of touch, I believe. And so it had occurred to him that wouldn't it be neat if we worked with startups that are working in a bit of a more dynamic environment where we can solve actual problems for them. And so time and time again now, we've given them a unique problem for them to crack, and they've taken a stab at it. More recently, one of our portfolio companies, BandHub, you guys should check them out, bandhub.com. They're now the largest online music collaboration community in the world. So just quite simply, people make music together on BandHub. But so they had a request where they wanted to, integrate some degree of machine learning to their software, where they can provide audio tracks of single instruments to the students. And based on timbres and certain subsets and frequencies, the students would be able to develop a machine learning system that can identify what type of instrument it's listening to. So that's just been one of the many neat things that we've done with Fordham and City College and Gutman. Also something similar, although not centered around data as much as it is entrepreneurship.
Yeah, it's really significant. You said a lot there, but I want to call out that I like that the Fordham University Center is called the Center for Digital Transformation. Mm-hmm. Someone consciously decided that was a name because it served the, you know, it declared what they were about, transformation, which I think
exactly.
is really significant. But I also like the idea that you're giving, I say kids, but you're giving college students something to work on that is real, that is fundamental, that is a startup, as opposed to the theoretical crap that we give them now, you know? Why aren't we going into, you know, have freshman year maybe be the basics, but by sophomore year, why aren't we going in there with accelerators and real business problems and making those the assignments?
Totally agreed.
That seems like such an obvious bit of low-hanging fruit, though. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that I would suspect that the rank and file at the colleges would be afraid that would cause dropouts, that would cause folks to say, oh, wow, this is much cooler. If I quit, I can do this full time. The trick would be to find the balance and ideally have someone have enough time that they could finish their degree and do a startup at the same time, perhaps.
And one thing that I want to note, and I think it was a brilliant observation of yours, to the audience listening, that's a great business opportunity if anyone should feel inclined to tackle it. But in large here, entrepreneurs are always looking for gaps and opportunities to do something a bit better. And so for me, you're entrepreneurially minded in that you noticed the gap and you said, wouldn't that be nice? And so for entrepreneurs, it's just this constant, that would be cool, or that could be done a lot better. And should you feel strong enough about one particular thing that maybe, usually it's like an issue that's close to home. So if there's something out for anyone listening that's just constantly comes to mind and it's just burning and you feel really strongly about it, and it certainly helps that your technical odds are, if you're listening to the show. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I think the business acumen just kind of falls into place and you may have something real in your hands.
Right. Absolutely. I like that term though, the gap, because I'm starting to think about where all the gaps are, right? Mm. There's the gap between the business person and the technical person, but up leveling that even more, I always talk about the gap between the business requirement, which is really easy to say, right?
Right.
Business person says, oh, well, I want the computer to identify what kind of instrument that is. Right, that required very little energy for me to say that. And then that turns into a 9-month project with a bunch of graduate students, you know.
Totally.
There's a huge gap there. I think business people, underestimate how complicated it is to write good, solid software.
I I agree. And I was in that bucket for so long. I remember when I brought in my first CTO, my first company was an on-demand laundry startup. So it was very heavy on the logistics front. And so pretty much my CTO was building a layer of logistics to power our deliveries and such. And we had to do things like routing the drivers and prioritizing which deliveries came first and which customers paid a premium for time sensitive orders and so on. And I came into this whole game of tech startups, again, having A, not been technical, but B, just kind of waving my wand and saying, okay, dude, do this. And I want it done in 3 days. And it was just this incredibly unrealistic expectation of my CTO. And through developing that relationship and a lot of arguing and a lot of headbutting and so forth, we've begun to get to a better and better place where he understood my sense of urgency because I cared only about growing the business. And I started uncovering, oh, okay, wow, front end development is a thing. Back end is a thing. There's different skill sets for each. And I even separated IT from the rest of the, so I began kind of drawing out the landscape of all things technical. And I think from the perspective of non-technical people, a tech person, and I put that, I was just using air quotes, is just this one person that kind of covers the entire spectrum of the whole thing, and they can act, they can work super quickly. And I've had to learn a hell of a lot about MVPs and kind of building in stages and reiterating and keeping your ears to the streets, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. The idea of the MVP, the minimally viable product, I think is also a bit of a concern. I remember working in startups in the 90s and we would do prototypes. We'd make basically, we called them click-throughs, right? You know, it was like, you know, the Windows app that you built really quickly in like Visual Basic 6. And if a business person saw it though, they're like, wow, I click on this button and the thing I wanted to have happen happened. It's done, right? whoa, this is a prototype.
Right.
If you show a business person, perhaps, you know, a website that you auto generated in Node and you used Twitter Bootstrap, they're going to think it's amazing. Like we're finished.
Totally. One of the things that, there's a quick story. And it actually happened a whole lot and something that my CTO at the time we still have a laugh about it to this day, but I can tell he was totally bitter about it. And that was whenever we went to go pitch big clients, they would ask me, oh, well, can your software do X, Y, or Z? And because I only cared about closing that deal, I would say, absolutely, it can do X and it can do Y and Z. And I would just sell up this, this incredibly grandiose vision. And then afterwards, I'd be like, oh, shit. And say, hey, man, do you think you can get that done by this date?
And that's such a typical, I'm sorry, but like you're not a unique snowflake. Everyone does that. Can you do that? Absolutely. Can you do that? And then, yeah, we've actually had, true story, at Microsoft, we've had times when one of our VPs would be giving a speech and then they mention a feature. And then we'd turn to each other and we'd say, oh, well, I guess we're making that.
that's funny, man. And then, of course, you know, afterwards, after the meeting, I'd say, all right, man, listen, I have a client dinner. All right, man, talk soon. And knowing good and well that he'd have to go and stay up all night building the thing while I was having a steak dinner with another prospect so I can sell him up on another set of features that he'd have to go and build. And so it's this vicious cycle that I've gotten much, 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 much better about. In fact, I would say I sympathize now more with the tech people, having, and now that I'm an active investor in the tech space. So, but it took an evolution, I would say.
Yeah. It's definitely a different kind of difficult though. You know, the example I always give is when I worked in finance for many years and I was the chief architect of a finance company, but my boss was the CTO. So I was the bridge between, you know, the engineering and the CTO, and he was the bridge up even further, like up into the execs. Right. So he was the business side of the technical and I was the technical side of the business. And we kind of balanced each other. And a chief architect was thinking about, is this the right technology stack? And then he would think about the business ramifications of picking a technology stack.
Oh, wow. That's really refreshing to me. I wasn't aware of that distinction there between, someone who's thinking about the business side of technology. Now, obviously though, his technical proficiency was pretty high, you know?
Yeah, he definitely was, but he also had a, I was the nerd that they would bring in for the steak dinners that didn't know how to order wine. And he was the business person who was extremely technical, could write the code, but also knew how to play golf. You know, it was one of those kind of balances. When a company gets larger, mm-hmm. I think sometimes, you need your kind of your chief architect, your chief programmer.
Totally.
And that's different from a CTO. You know, a CTO is the person that keeps the CEO and the, you know, the technical person from killing each other.
Wow. Now that's funny, because in a startup on the opposite end of the spectrum, right? When you have like a 3-person team, the CTO is typically the programmer, the architect, everything. Mm. And, perhaps after some seed funding, the CTO essentially becomes a project manager and still is hands on. And probably post series, it depends on how good the team is. But one of the things that I see often, and it's really kind of sad, but as startups bring in more and more capital and they have increasing pressure, there comes a point where when you raise a financing round, it's no longer a relief. You're now thinking about how you can turn that money into 20x the money that you got.
Right.
And so they start bringing in these high-powered executives, and sometimes the original co-founders step down into VP roles and all kinds of stuff. But certainly a story for another day.
Yeah, I think that in this particular case, my CTO had both an MBA and a master's in computer science, so he was kind of the ideal individual for that. And I think that that would be like, that's the unicorn that you'd want to find, someone who is the bridge between the business and the technical. I think also though that programmers, they want to be CTOs because it's such a big title, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's like the old, I want to be the CTO, the most chief technical person. That doesn't mean you need to be the best programmer or the smartest programmer.
Mm. That's smart. Something that I hadn't considered, that I'm going to run over and tell the folks at the accelerator now. Actually, they're over right next to me hacking away. I'm in the conference room.
Oh, very cool. So folks can check this out at cofound.co. And can they follow you on Twitter?
Yeah, totally. I'm at John Henry Style. Pretty active on there. So that's JohnHenry Style, like the word STYLE. So check me out. I'm happy to jump on a call or a quick conversation with anyone who's interested in learning a bit more about what we're up to.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much for your time today.
Scott, thanks so much for having me, man. I appreciate it.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.